Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tone Irish podcast. We're just about to go into chat with our latest guest, the one and only Philly McMahon, and we're up here in Finglas at the moment. But before we do, we want to say a special thank you to Cathal Heenan of Mainua.
Thanks, Cathal, for the website. It looks fantastic. It's very easy to work.
So that's MyNewApp, available at MyNewApp.com for any of your app or website needs. Link in description. Thanks, Cathal.
Thank you.
This episode is sponsored by local entrepreneur Danny O'Donovan of QuickMinutes.com. QuickMinutes is a specialized meeting management application that streamlines the administrative process in running a meeting.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Tone Irish podcast. And this week we are on the road with Unity Media Network. I am your host, James Leonard, joined by my co-host,
Timmy.
We are on the road. We are in the Big Smoke. We are in B27 Gym in Finglas with the one and only Philly McMahon. How are we keeping, Philly?
I'm great. Thanks for traveling up.
We were delighted that you accepted to come on. I know you're a very busy man. You have a lot going on. And we're really humbled that you're actually come on the show. I was very excited to meet you. We've been in correspondence for a few months, but alas, over lockdown, stuff was put on hold. So finally, we get to meet. It's great to be here. You're from Ballymun.
We're not
far from Ballymun here.
No.
Can you tell us a little about where you're from and what it was like growing up?
So I suppose I'll start from where a lot of people kind of will probably think of the area as an area that has a lot of crime and drugs and problems, and you know they're not wrong, but there's a huge amount of really good stuff in the area. But I'll start from, I suppose, when I grew up in Ballymun, it was a special community to me. It gave me and shaped me all I have. And if you were to ask me, you know, if you were to redo it all over again, would you prefer to live maybe in a different community, maybe an upper class community that had 12 bedrooms in a house, or would you live in your flat in Ballymun? I wouldn't have changed it. So for me, as I said, it gave me a lot of gifts. The community of Ballymun gave me a lot of gifts and a lot of life skills growing up. So when I grew up in Ballymun, the community had a huge amount of issues with the drug epidemic, especially heroin. Unfortunately, my brother fell into that pathway. I would say sport was my saviour. Playing soccer and GAA certainly gave me a focus, and the negative energy I had, I suppose, was funneled into that. And obviously with the drug epidemic that Ballymun had and the country had, you know, we didn't know how to deal with it. Our government didn't know how to deal with it, probably still don't today. But, you know, crime came with that. So, and that's why the area has a huge amount of stigma and shame around it. It's why young kids in the area would struggle with their self-belief, self-esteem, confidence. And it's probably why over years that the drug culture and the crime culture hasn't changed in the area, because it's generational and the trauma is still in the area. And unfortunately, when you do 100 things good for the area, it just takes one bad thing to change that good thing, that the good things that have been done, the positive things that have been done.
Yeah, sounds a lot like where we're from, Timmy, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's pretty much the same. Like myself and James, we grew up in an area called Knockmaheeny, Cork City. And it's the exact same as you just stated. You know, there's a lot of good things going on up there. There's a lot of great people up there. But when something really bad happens, it's like it's expected because of the area, you know. So we can definitely identify with that.
Like, put it in context, The Young Offenders is based on where we're from, but we do not like act like anything like The Young Offenders, you know. But some people say it adds to the stigma, others say it's a bit of fun. That's a debate.
Same Adam and Paul, the film.
And it's a debate for another podcast. Just to kind of show the parallels between where you're from and where we're from, Trinity College Dublin have a deprivation index freely available online. It's an Excel document. And they have, like, the deprivation in Ireland is scored on Pubble Maps and choosing all the statistics. The top two are in Ballymun, the most deprived areas, and then number three is Knocknaheeny, and then in the rest of the top.
So you're telling me you're posher than me because I'm from Knocknaheeny, I'm from Ballymun. This is a Cork Dublin thing now, is it?
Yeah, and then you'd like say Moy Ross and all. There's lots of parallels to be drawn, and it's just generations of social policy and, I suppose, structures that create problems in these communities. Like in our community, pile of social housing originally sent into an area with no services, similar to Ballymun.
Ballymun was developed because the overcrowded tenements in the inner city, and the government said, like, you know, this is a great initiative. There's going to be accommodation for 20,000 people. And they basically pushed everybody out to this community, which is a brilliant location between the airport and the inner city. A beautiful complex, beautiful, took from the design, took from an estate in Germany. And they didn't, align the amenities that were needed for those, the people that actually were from the inner city coming out. So, and what happened then, which is not an awful lot of people know, which is crazy to think. There was a lot of people that moved out of the area when Ballymun was developed, and a lot of the people that were left there were people with mental health issues, psychiatric issues, and that trauma definitely was generational and passed down. And that's why Ballymun became a very lucrative area for drug dealers, because you've got you've got a huge amount of this community struggling with trauma, and their solution to overcome that trauma was take drugs. So a very smart move. I don't know if it just organically happened with drug dealers in the area that went, or did they cop that Ballymun had people that were really struggling mentally. Let's target that area and let's make a lot of money from it. But that's essentially what happened. And that hasn't changed. It's crazy to think that was in the, you know, the 80s and the late 80s and the early 90s. And it kind of really hit. That was kind of the epic of when it hit. But it had been building up over, you know, the 70s and 80s and whatever, like, into the rave scenes and stuff like that. But nothing has changed.
Yeah.
People always ask me, what's the difference now? You would think that the government look at a community that has struggled for so many years and would intervene because it would save so much money for the exchequer. Nothing has changed.
Yeah. I think one striking difference between Ballymun and where we're from and Cork in general, we didn't have the heroin epidemic what you had. Like, heroin came into Dublin late 70s, early 80s, same time it hit Manchester, Liverpool. And there's a lot of social context why that happened, not least poverty. Mm. But in Cork, we avoided that. It was only around 2004, 2005 when heroin really hit Cork. I remember being in Cork prison 2006, I'd say, and there was a handful of us on heroin. And 2007, there was a handful not on heroin. That's how quickly it came into Cork, and it devastated the community. I mean,
it was very, very hard to accept, because my first introduction to heroin would have been in a treatment centre at the age of 16 in France, and I seen people addicted to heroin come in from countries like Italy and Spain, being driven there by their family members, you know, and being left there. No, on the way and the journey to the centre in France, they'd be given whatever drugs they need just to get them on the journey, you know. And they'd come into the centre then, and there'd be two of us to look after them, and just to show them around the place. But they'd be stoned, completely stoned still. And after a while, when they're coming down off the heroin, you'd see some of the things that happened, like, really kind of frightened me. Like, for example, there was just one female. She offered me and another guy that was looking after her sex to be able to get more drugs, you know. And when I seen that at a young age, what heroin could possibly do to somebody, it frightened me. And there was another guy as well that died from cold turkey of heroin. He wasn't getting any methadone or any form of medication to come off the heroin. He was just complete cold turkey with a form of medicine, a horrible medicine that we were giving him. And I really, really got scared of it, right? It was, heroin wasn't in Cork at this stage. This was mid-90s. But it came in then in 2004. I seen it. I would have been addicted to the cocaine and alcohol and tablets at the time. You know,
Timmy would be slightly older generation to me. I like to remind him, but myself and Timmy's brothers would have been a little bit younger, and we kind of got caught with the heroin. You know, now there's a lot of people watch our show, have family members on heroin, and there's a fair stigma to it, as you know. Can you explain what it's like, or can you identify with those people and maybe give them some words of comfort or encouragement? Or? Yeah.
I think the big problem with the stigma is the policy, you know, that it's evident now that people from working class communities are getting a little bit more educated because pathways being set out for them, like you used to and me. We're setting pathways out for the next generation to go to university, become more educated and challenge the standards of your culture. And the problem now is that the policy makers in the country are kind of going, whoa, we've never been challenged like this before. So when we see that there's a huge correlation between people that struggle with drugs or addiction is due to mental health, well, then we must treat it as a mental health issue. So if we don't change from a legalize, I don't mean we have to legalize it, but we can decriminalize it like other countries have done it. And when we break down that, you know, that guy there is struggling with heroin, but it's not against the law, he's just got mental health issues, well, then we can start to change that stigma. There's a doctor, Sharon Lambert, you probably came across.
She's on the podcast last week.
Is she? Yeah, she's brilliant. Yeah. Really good. Really interesting in what she's doing work-wise, research-wise. But she had a study out, I think it was last year, the year before, and it was about the effects of families from a drug and alcohol-related death. And she spoke about a family, a story that she took from a girl that basically her brother had was a heroin addict and sat down one night with her and her mom and said, "Mom, you won't have to worry about me anymore. Everything will be all right." And he went upstairs and didn't wake up the next day. He committed suicide, and that was obviously due to this you know, this shame and stigma. That there's a huge amount of, especially heroin addicts, that will get to that point where they'll think that they've lost all self worth, and that it's better off they're not hearing this. They're letting people down all the time, and that's not what, like, we need to. As a society, what we need is people that struggle with addiction, especially heroin addiction and other drug addictions, alcohol, whatever it may be, that we need to keep them on the planet long enough for them to hit rock bottom to ultimately make the decision to come off drugs. We, as a society, will ultimately not have the power to make somebody come off drugs. They have to want it themselves, but we need to have the support there for them. So that, I suppose, is why we have the stigma and shame. Years and years of being passed down that it's wrong to take drugs, it's against the law, so treat people really bad. And ultimately, when someone goes on that cycle of smoking, cannabis, ecstasy, cocaine, crack cocaine possibly, heroin addiction, to being a functional addict, to being on the streets, being a homeless addict, to end up in prison because of that, to feed that 20 to 30,000 euro habit a year, that, you know, there has to be a better process to that. You know, why have we not, as a country, not looked at saving, even if you don't care that you haven't got a family member or you haven't been in that situation, why haven't we as a government, as a country, looked at it and said, for every euro we spend on that young person, we're going to save 4 euro. You know, like, why? And that's where my head is spinning, You know, is there too much money spinning around? Like, the guards have a really hard job, especially I see up in here in Dublin. You would have seen the series around the K. Even yeah. having the name the K is just it's a really bad yeah. name to stigmatize a community. But they are really under-resourced. But I think the guards, when the Kinahan Hutch feud kicked off, I think there was 60 million euro worth of overtime spent in that area of our exchequer, like, you know, 60 million extra for extra time, for overtime, sorry, for guards. So there's so much of this money spinning around that you have to question, you know, who makes these decisions? Could we be spending all the money we incarcerate prisoners for, you know, having, you know, being imprisoned or incarcerated for having personal use of drugs? And they say they'll say there's not many. There's 16,000 incidents of it, right? But can we put that money into the health system because it's a mental health issue?
Yeah.
And we definitely have troubles with our healthcare system, so we need more money in that area. In anyway, but our courts will be less full. You know, our prisons will definitely be more. You know, we'll only have drug dealers in prisons because instead of focusing on people with personal use of drugs because decriminalized, we will be focusing on people selling the drug. The guards will be focusing on drug dealers.
Yeah. They've actually done that in Portugal.
Yeah.
They've decriminalised personal use. If someone's caught with drugs that are for personal use on them, they're left go, you know. But if they're caught with a large quantity, and I think actually Sharon Lambert stated this in the podcast, that their death rate from people having overdoses and stuff for 1 year in the whole of Portugal was two people, you know, like,
And we have over one a day.
Yeah. And the amount of money that they saved from bringing people through the courts and everything else associated with people getting arrested and brought to court, they were able to pump back into the system and help people with recovery and all these other things.
There's pros and cons to it. And like in everything, in terms of when you change something so big in terms of a culture, there's pros and cons to it. And people will say, oh, yeah. But like, I mean, decriminalization is a kind of a buzzword, and it gets the topic out there, it gets the narrative out there, it gets people speaking about addiction, which doesn't really happen otherwise in the media, because not an awful lot of people like speaking about it, not a lot of people like coming out and speaking. So what yous are doing is amazing, like coming out and speaking about your issues that you've had in the past and helping others look and go, there's two lads that have changed and went through adversity and look what they're doing now. Like, that's what we need, them peer guidance pathways. But ultimately, what Portugal done really well was that they put a multidisciplinary approach around decriminalisation. So as you said, the money they were spending on incriminating people, they were actually putting into helping them and putting into the healthcare system. So if you were caught with personal use, you were brought to a dissuasion committee in an office block and not a guard station. You're brought in, you sit in front of, which I've been in for one of the meetings. The guy sits in front of the health expert and basically says, have you got a problematic drug issue? And he says, yes, okay. You're going to get a fine. It's a small fine, but you're going to be given the opportunity to go to rehab, right? Now, it's still, the big problem we have is people get mixed up with legalization and decriminalization. So I've been on TV and media, wherever, and people have said, it'll open the floodgates if you decriminalise drugs. No, it won't. And let's be honest, the floodgates are already opened. They are already opened. We have the third highest overdose rate in Europe per capita. We're a quite small population in terms of countries in Europe, and yet we're the third highest, right? And we're spending millions upon millions with the policies we've had in the past. And yes, it's great that we are a little bit ahead of where we were a couple of years ago in that it's a health-led approach. But the problems we have is that we are still stigmatizing people. So still there's people that are struggling with drugs that are taking their own lives because of the stigma and the shame. And the problem that we have is that the money is still circulating in areas that it shouldn't be. So for me, when we look at Portugal, there's a lot of good things. But ultimately, if we want to impact this drug trade in the country, we need to devalue it. We devalue it by decriminalizing it. You know, it's one of those things that maybe you have experienced that when it's against the law, sometimes it makes you want to go and get it, you know. But the other side of it is, it's not going to open the floodgates. Cocaine is normalized now in all social classes. Weed and hash, the same thing. Heroin is not really normalized because it's seen as the dirtiest drug out of them all, like, but we still have a huge amount of people taking it.
Yeah.
So, and it starts off where you're based. So you're talking about earlier on Cork only hitting Cork a lot later than Dublin. Just imagine Cork is a city and it's only being hit in 2004. Other counties are not going to be hit with it. So only now Kilkenny are getting hit with it really hard. Mm-hmm. Other counties, like I've went to Tyrone GAA clubs and they're saying, Philly, can you come up and talk in the GAA club because we've caught two of our players taking cocaine in the toilet. I'm like, Jesus, that's so small compared to what we've experienced. But isn't it great that clubs are already thinking of getting to that level of being proactive and getting people to come out and talk about it, because that's what's needed.
Yeah, I think as well for a lot of the people watching, they might know some of the terms we're using. So legalization means drugs are legal to the point like tobacco is legal and alcohol is legal.
Yeah.
Decriminalization, the drugs are still illegal. Mm. It's just the person that's using them is not sent to court. They're sent, it's addressed as a health issue.
Yeah.
And they go before social workers or doctors or whatever.
Yeah, they deal with the person's issues rather than the addiction.
Exactly. And we got to kind of, like, I want to give credit to Senator Lynn Nguyen because she does a lot of work. Like, she's a represent. Like, I see her as a representative of our area too, because she speaks for working class people, unlike anybody else, you know what I mean? And she drives stuff in the Senate around decriminalisation, around spent conviction, stuff that's very dear to our heart. And, like, what's your thoughts on Ireland's policy of decriminalisation for the first two offences? Let me put this in the context. I could pick up two convictions in the one day, Philly, and then after that, normal service is resumed. So in Ireland, going forward, it'll be, if you get caught for drugs for possession, personal possession, you'll get the decriminalisation thing where you go to a brief intervention, kind of a health-led approach for the first offence and the second offence.
Three-strike policy.
But then on the third, you're gone. That's brilliant if you're a student in Trinity or UCC, you get caught with a bit of weed or a bit of hash twice and you'll get out of it without a conviction. But for a drug addict or a chronic drug user around here or in Cork, it's not really relevant, is it?
Well, the question is, when have you seen somebody that struggled with drug addiction ever stop taking after three? You know, so it makes absolutely no sense. Absolutely no sense. So I was a part of help create awareness for the public consultation when it first started off with Minister Catherine Bourne. So she asked me to come in and build the awareness of the campaign for the public consultation. So I went in and I said a piece. And I actually, do you know what? It was the first time I actually broke down in front of an audience because I spoke about the embarrassment I had of walking by my brother. And it never really hit me. It hit me really bad then. And I actually started crying in front of everybody. Lynn was there. Lynn Ryan was there. And I was like, you know, I'm a man. I shouldn't really cry out there. But I was like, do you know what? At least these people sitting in front of me who are a huge amount of stakeholders in this area will respect that I'm somebody that's dealt through losing a loved one through addiction. And what happened after that was just so frustrating for me because a working group was set up. So you got everybody, the 20,000 people filled out the consultation. I believe now, I don't know if this is a fact, a huge amount was pro decriminalization, right? And the chairperson of that working group, who was a judge, came out with the report after it and said, we're going to come out with this new policy. It's a three-strike policy. And some of the article that he came out, some of the stuff in the article that came out was just mind-boggling for me. He said, actually, it's better for you to go to prison because you get recovery. You'll go into recovery in there. I couldn't get my head around. I kind of said to myself, have you ever been in prison? Have you ever seen what happens in prison? I've lads in my course in Mount Joy who've never took drugs before they went to prison and ended up on drugs in there. And he also said then that they had a guy come over, don't quote me on this, I think from Colorado, and he was an expert in legalization of drugs when they legalized marijuana. And straight away, I kind of said to myself, who was talking about legalization here? We were talking about decriminalization.
Mm-hmm.
So he mixed that up. Like, and I was like, How could you make that mistake? Like? Yeah,
it's a big difference.
And what it does is, in the media, when you have somebody talking about legalization, society just pricks their ears up and go, oh, you're right. Here's a judge speaking about legalization. But hold on, we weren't talking about that. Yeah. We were talking about decriminalization. Yeah. So when you talk about a three-strike policy, the first question I'd have is, when has somebody ever stopped taking drugs after three warnings? When their family has tried to tell them to stop taking drugs all their lives. I used to use tough love, thinking that that would be the big thing, that my brother would stop taking drugs. I'd ignore him in the street. It was the opposite that was needed. I needed to be there and say, John, when you decide to come off drugs, I'll be there for you. I'll be the brother. But I was taught to use love, one of the most powerful things we have as human beings. I thought love was the one thing that was going to get him off drugs, when I didn't realize how potent and how strong this little substance was. Yeah. And people that don't take drugs don't understand that. I never took a drug in my life in terms of illegal drugs, but I understand it from having a family member. And, you know, anybody that's taking drugs will understand how powerful that is. You know, so for me, we have people making decisions that probably haven't been involved enough in the area, I think. You know, I really do. I think, and if you think of all the people that have struggled with drugs, or their family members have struggled with that whole experience, we don't really have enough of them making decisions in the hierarchy of this country in terms of the political world. You know, we'll have probably people in the political world have said that they've smoked a joint or whatever else. But how many do we have up there that have went through the process, that these people that are the most vulnerable people in society that are on the streets because of the heroin addiction, how many of those do we actually speak for? Lynn Ruan would be a prime example that I would buzz when I hear her speak, you know?
Yeah.
But we don't have enough at the top, you know?
Yeah, but even like when I was getting myself sorted, I wanted to get a job where I could help people, you know, and give back. So I done that, and I was working in addiction service, homeless services in Cork. But I felt I wasn't having enough of an impact, you know, like maybe help somebody, give them a cup of tea, link them in with support. I wanted to do more. So I think, like what you're saying there, is I'm trying to move into the policy space now, you know. I'm writing theses and doing PhDs and trying to do the podcast. And like, we're trying to have our voice and the agenda now, you know what I mean? You can't be making policies that impact us without us having our input. We can have our input, as I see it, helping an individual person. You know, we can have it by broadcasting it on YouTube, writing research, because governments, everything has to be evidence-based, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To have credibility, you have to have qualifications and all these things, you know?
You need a group of people that have gone down that road, lived the life, had the experience, come together, that are doing very, very well, to build a policy. You know, not people that have no experience what it's like to grow up in poverty, to grow up in areas where drugs are the norm, prison is the norm. You know, we need people making policies that have gone through it and know what people are suffering in these poverty, these areas like Ballymun, Knocknaheeny, Moyross, wherever. There's areas like that all over the country. We need people, our own people, just to listen to this podcast. Yeah. People that have authority, they've built up, they're educated, they get into the positions where we can change these policies and look after people instead of putting them into a corner, like you're somebody in school and you're a nuisance, putting them in the corner and leaving them there. What we're doing is putting them into prisons and leaving them there, and it's just coming back and back and back.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it has been for me, my own family, like it's just,
We think these things are filters, you know, in society. Like, we think school is a really good filter, you know, that we develop skills, let's say, from school that feeds us in a certain direction in life, you know, and that's the pathway we've been dealt with, like, you know. But when you grow up in a working class community, you start off on an uneven playing field, right, because you're given a lot less. So when you start off living in you're born in an upper class, middle class background, you start a little bit, you know, you have a head start because you're not dealt with
poverty,
you know, being the big thing. And we don't realize how much poverty there is actually in this country. Like, I always say, and I got this from a friend of mine, Trina O'Connor, who's a criminologist, and she made me think about this one day, about my dad. My dad died of cancer in 2018, and he didn't have private insurance. So my dad was born in West Belfast, shot in the stomach at 16, joined the Provisional IRA, escaped prison in Uri, and then went on the run, came to Ballymun, and that's where I came. And I become an All-Ireland winner and everything else. And it's crazy kind of coincidence what's had to happen.
You could have easily, conflict. You could have easily grown up in the north and become a provost.
Yeah, yeah. But it's crazy to think his conflict was the Troubles, yeah. You know, fighting for the Catholic communities in where he was from, and for the struggle of, you know, wanting the United Ireland. And them values have, you know, rubbed off on me, and my conflict is poverty. You know, I want to try bridge that social inequality gap. For me, like it's so important that we realise that the trauma we have, you know, can shape us so much, like, you know. So if we don't get to the root cause, first of all, of the trauma in these communities, well, then there's no point in changing policy. So there's two ends to the spectrum, you know. Mm-hmm. Policy is one end, culture of communities is the other end, you know. So yeah. We need to look at the two ends of the spectrum. Yeah.
Can I ask to talk a little bit about the work you do in prisons,
yeah,
and your half-time talk with young people?
Yeah, so we're talking about that spectrum, and I believe what I want to do, what the purpose I've been given from, I suppose, the energy I've got from speaking about my brother's addiction, which fell out of my mouth after an All-Ireland semi-final. A fellow I was marking said, your brother's a junkie and he died from a drug overdose, and had the best game of my life.
That's
my
actually
career.
Despicable to hear that.
Yeah, but you know,
it just shows the lack of understanding as well. That's there.
Yeah, but you know, in my head, I was like, you had to go that level to get.
You know, you're winning.
I have you. You know, so I'd.
I don't know, but I've been that easy in him, no, really, to be honest.
Well, look,
that's just me personally.
Yeah, we all make mistakes, you know. So I believe he made a mistake that day because I had a really good game. I got man of the match that day. I scored more than him, and I'm a defender, he's a forward. But we all make mistakes. And for me, I spoke about that after the game. I was that angered. But the response I got was amazing, which gave me a purpose to go, do you know what? This is something really I can latch on to in terms of life, not just about business or All-Irelands or, you know, cars or houses, whatever it is. It's about a purpose in life. And I was very lucky at that age to be able to get that. Yeah. You know, not many people get at that age to develop a purpose in life. So it started off with like, okay, there's so many people want me to talk about this. What? How do I get it out there? And I set up a pilot scheme in 2012 to help high risk youths and drug addicts and people that were on the social welfare for longer than a year. And that went really well. And that kind of, the following year, actually the social aspect of our country got privatized. The funding was cut in the social programming, and we lost our partner who funded the course. So I said, you know what, I'm not going to let this kind of affect this kind of project I was running. I'm going to go off and set up a charity. So I went out and reached out to somebody who had a really big network of very successful people in different areas. And we got 13 people on this board, set up a charity, took us 2 years to develop it, and that's when we developed Halftime Talk, the charity. So anybody that was looking for information or support, which was a huge amount, I'm sure you get it as well, it was funneled into Halftime Talk. And to get it out there even further, I said, right, I'm going to do a book, because there's still people asking about it. So we put all the story into the book, The Choice, and then I wanted to challenge the policy of the country, so I developed we've done the documentary, The Hardest Hit. And So that was just getting it out there, using my sporting profile to try impact that kind of area. And we're talking, when I was telling you about the spectrum, there's three parts I want to challenge. Mountjoy, we developed a program, a leadership program in Mountjoy called the Unfucked Movement. And it's spelled UNFUCCCKD. And the three C's stand for change, culture, community. So we wanted to get these lads, and we wanted to mold and take out the leadership qualities they had within them and first of all use the community of prison to mould and to develop, basically. And in Mountjoy Prison, you have the main jail and you have the progression unit, which is quite new. Anybody that wants to change, they basically put their hands up. If they have a drug problem, they go through the detox unit and they come up to the progression unit. And it's a much better place to do your time culturally. No violence, absolutely no violence. You know, a lot of bitching, no violence compared to the main jail. Drugs, yes, there is drugs. Never get rid of drugs in prisons. You know, they have to manage it a little bit better, but much less drugs up here than there is down there. And I wanted to shine a light on that, you know, that there's really good stuff happening up here and this is amazing for a prison setting culturally. So we developed the leadership program, and basically the leadership program is getting these lads to, you know, not take drugs, develop all the life skills, and to get other people and pass that on to emerging leaders. Keep passing that on. So it's peer guidance. It's what you are doing. It's using people's stories and examples to pass it on to the next people coming through and saying, this is the better way of doing time. And when they reintegrate into society, then that they do the same in their communities, that they actually, you know, they're shown by example of, this is what not to do, because this is the way you'll end up. And that's what I had when I had the pathway with John. Seeing the pain and suffering he had as a drug addict, and I didn't want to go that way. So telling our kids over generations, don't take drugs because it'll kill you, hasn't worked. Yeah. How many times do kids hear nowadays, don't take drugs, it'll kill you, and they've took drugs and they're going, you're full of shit. I've took drugs and I'm not dead.
Yeah.
Right? So the message has to change. It has to be, we have to show the pain and suffering, because that's how I went the other way. So using the guys in prison, when they get out of the Unfucked movement into their communities, that they basically are role models to the next generation of emerging leaders. So that's what we're trying to do. So we're developing a group of people together. We've a sociologist, a criminologist. Sharon Lambert is actually in the group. And we're linking in with IBM. And we're basically going into prison. We're going to extract the stories and the experiences from prisoners and get the red flags along the way. And then we're going to go into communities and we're going to look at young kids that have the similar red flags. And then we're going to go back to the government or somebody and we're going to say, we know that this kid is highly likely going to end up like him. It's going to cost this amount of money. Give us that money. Let's intervene and let's see, can we change that pathway? So what you're doing there is changing generational cycles, and you're saving the country millions, absolutely millions. And you also have to realize the impact of the victims that we'll have less in society. So someone murdering somebody, the trauma families go through because of that. The person that murdered somebody hit their family, the person that was murdered, their family, the community. It's so big. And we could have stopped that potentially at a very young age.
Yeah. It's very exciting. It's very exciting to think about, isn't it, Tim?
That's a fantastic thing you're doing there.
I wonder, would we get it in Cork?
Look, if it works, if you think about it, if we had, let's say, six primary schools in Ballymun, and there was one kid in each of those schools that had a thing called ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, which you might know about, if they're 4+ ACEs, we know that they're going to highly, there's a good chance they're going to go down the pathway of drugs, crime, maybe have a child at a very young age, have mental health issues. Now, if we intervene, right, what we stopping? We are stopping victims in society. We're stopping drug taking. We're preventing mental health issues. We're preventing people going to prison and child detention centers, which costs millions. And essentially what we're doing is we're changing the country, the culture of the country. You know, that's the big thing.
Can you tell the people watching how much it costs to keep a young person in Oberstown for a year?
Yeah, so Oberstown was developed because the progression unit in Mountjoy used to be St. Pat's, which is a child detention center. Now, they've changed that over to the healthcare system. So they were basically like, we can't deal with kids under 18 in the criminal justice system. We'll change it to the healthcare system. So that's being changed over. And they developed this facility called Oberstown. And it's based in North County Dublin. And it's a €22 million running facility a year. 22 million to the exchequer, right? And that breaks down to every young person that goes through that process, it's €340,000 a year. Now, employees of Oberstown won't like me saying that because they do great work, right? But I went out and I said to the guys, what's the difference between this and prison? They have cells, You know, and let me make this point. This is very clear as well. That I have to make clear that there is a point for young under 18s to go to detention centres. There is. You have to be. There has to be some. I don't have another answer to that. If someone said, well, what's the, if you don't have Oberstown, what's the answer? It should be the last resort. You know, when it's a really, really bad crime, they should end up in something like that. But there's a huge amount of kids ending up in there that prison life becomes normalised. So a guy said to me, I said to him, he says, we're doing great work here. He says, there's kids here that don't want to go home. I said, that's what's wrong with society.
Yeah.
That kids don't want to go home. That's how bad their home is. But I said, what about that kid now? That kid will want to go on to prison because they think it's all right. Right? So the 340,000, if they spend a year there, or 2 years there, there's 680,000. And then they go to Mountjoy Prison for €90,000 a year. You're up to €1 million. And highly likely their peers, their friends, their parents, or their siblings have went through that process. So families, these family cycles are costing millions. You know, yeah. So when you look at my story, John went to Pat's, John went to Mountjoy, and he would have cost, let's say, up to nearly €1 million. If sport and a person, an inspirational role model for me, Paddy Christie, didn't see the good in me, I would have cost the country that as well.
Yeah. And you know what? Your story as well shows the importance of sport. Like when I was growing up, I was big into sport. Timmy would have been very talented footballer as well. And we would have grown up with people on our team and all, but we would have dropped out. And the lads that stayed in sport, they do well. Like, they might have a few shaky years in their teens and what have you, they might experiment or whatever. But once they stay part of the GA club or the football club or the boxing club, they tend to ride it out, you know? Yeah. But it's when the young people drop out of sport, that's when they're in big trouble. What do you think, Tim?
Particularly GA. I know a lot of GA players. I think they're more connected. They're, you know, I played soccer a lot. GA wasn't, I would have played it when I was younger. But the soccer is more of a social pub thing.
Mm.
You know, a lot of drugs involved as well. But the GA, I know a lot of GA players at home and I'm friends with a lot of them. And they're more, it's more of a real kind of solid sport. You
it's
know?
A different culture.
Yeah, it's GA completely different. Culture.
And I think the GA clubs, like our local GA club is St. Vincent's. We have an Apairsheag as well, not far, the Glen, and they're all kind of the big Northside clubs. But the GA invest a lot of money in the clubs. They have second to none facilities. Mm. Compared to the soccer clubs, you know, the soccer clubs, like you wouldn't be able to compare them with the GA, but then the GA they have, as you know, there's like under fives up to seniors and everything in between. It's a huge community, and they look out for each other, provide jobs for each other. It's just a great thing to be a part of. That unfortunately, me and Timmy didn't. But when I look at the lads who are a part of it, they're doing well today. No fellas that grew up in the GA clubs, they're business owners, they're professionals, or tradesmen, whatever. Yeah. They do really well. So I always say, you know, if people is texting us saying, oh, my son or my daughter is going through a difficult time, they're doing this and that, but they're still going to football, they're still going to the boxing, they say, just keep them in the sport and they'll ride it out, you know. When they drop out of the sport, kind of, we'll worry then. But if they're, you know, they're just going through teenage stuff, keep them in the sport and they'll be fine. And that was your experience too with Paddy Christie. And it just shows as well, like if you're a coach, you know, the importance of mentoring that young person.
Yeah. Look, it's there's so much in that piece, like, of sport. I done a talk down in Knockaheeny there last year, was it? I think it was last year. This lockdown, you don't know what years you're in.
I know.
But it was amazing. The community guards down there set it up. And there was the boxing club, athletics, the GA clubs, there was soccer clubs. It was just amazing to see. It was in the school there. And it was brilliant, you know, because it was people. And, you know, when you come up, you come from a working class community, you kind of, you've got this little bit of a block, a mental block when guards do things that you don't buy into it, that you go, guards, I'm from Ballymun, like, you know, I'll be a rat or whatever, like, you know. Yeah. But all the sports clubs are represented. It was amazing. So it showed how highly the community guard that organised it was held in terms of respect. You know, he wasn't seen maybe as a guard. He was seen as somebody trying to help the sports clubs. And it was just brilliant for me. It was great. But and I tell you why I'm trying to make a point around this, is that it's important that we realise within a community that it's not about kids picking, oh, go and play Gaelic football, or go and play hurling or camogie, or stick with the Gaa. And that's hard for people to listen to coming from someone from a Gaa background. But a kid plays sport, you know, that's brilliant, regardless of what that sport is. If it's chess,
yeah,
yes, great. It means you're not taking drugs or committing crime, like, you know. So for me, that has always been a struggle, especially in Dublin, when you have people competing for young kids to play sport. It's like, we need you to play here because we're struggling with numbers. Whereas we need that thought process to change to, once a kid's playing sport, that's great. Yeah. You know, if somebody from my local hurling club, Satanta, asks me to go down and do something to help them, I'll do that. And it's not this thing of, I'm not helping you, I'm from Ballymun Kickhams. No, I'm from Ballymun, and I'm all down to help young kids, you know. So the question I would have with that group that we're doing is, it's a really interesting thing that I don't have the answer to, and maybe you do. Why did you stop playing sport? And that's where we need to get to it. You know, it's what point did you drop off, and why did you stop?
Probably getting the better buzz off the drugs. That would be my thinking around it. Because what I was getting from the playing on a football field, the glory of, you know, well done, or, you know,
the buzz.
I was getting something better
from
the drugs and the alcohol, and that took me away from all that then, you know.
But it was probably a bit before that.
That
was going to be the deciding factor whether you're going to give up sport or not.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was, and I shouldn't be able to tell you, but I think my thought process is, when someone drops off at sport, it's catching them before they actually got to that stage where they were challenging the buzz from the adrenaline from playing sport compared to the drug. It's like, when did it happen? Where did it start? And how do you get, like, the why is actually, it's well before they get to the drugs is the reason they dropped off. Because Ballymun Kickhams, Paddy Christie saved a huge amount of kids from that pathway, but there was a lot that didn't get saved. And I always put it down to is, if we had somebody, Paddy done his best, by the way, but if we had somebody within the club that could have seen it a bit earlier and said, I'm going to get this fella here who actually used to play for Ballymun, struggled, not played anymore, to speak to this kid who's just about to go that pathway, maybe that could be the solution.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think what could work there as well, in terms of, if somebody's dropping off the sport, the act of not going anymore or quitting, that has happened months previous, or maybe years. You know what I mean? So then it's about, like, if the teacher has young Philly, and young Philly's missing days in school, or he's not present, he's present physically but not mentally,
should be red flags.
And link him with the coach and say, how is he at training? And is it, no matter, come to think of it, no, he's getting lax with the training, he's starting to miss days, or he's turning up late or leaving early, or he looks like he's not interested. Then you get the services involved. It saves us 380 grand a year in Orbistown later on. Like, if you put a tiny fraction of that into support from the young person and the family as well.
Because there's so many sports clubs out there that might have the mindset of, especially if you come from an upper class background where there's sporting clubs in the area, that it's seen as a really bad thing. Not help that young lad, kick him out. You know, he's pulling our club down. You know, and I see that all over the country when I'm doing talks in rural GA communities, that it's seen as, like, he's the bad egg of this community, get rid of him. They should be saying, we're the focal point, all the sports clubs, wherever sport there is, we're the focal point. Sport, we're here to basically help you develop skills, life skills through sport. But we want to wrap around you and make sure you come. And that is, like, that for me is the big thing in terms of changing cultures and changing pathways, because I'm an example of that. I had sport to do that for me, like, you know. So I think sports clubs need to realise the impact that they can play in young kids, like, you know.
Yeah, before we wrap up, we can't not talk about Seven All-Irelands. Like, as I said to you before, off camera, my father's a Dublin man, he's from Inchicore, and he five brothers, they're all big Dubs fans. I was born in Dublin myself, so I'm a football Dublin supporter and a Cork hurling supporter. But I grew up watching Dublin. But I grew up watching Dublin, and But I suppose when I got to my teens, I felt it was stupid standing in Hill 16 saying, come on, Dublin, with my cock accent, you know, so I had to make a decision.
Listen, my dad, as I said, is West Belfast, and he was screaming, come on, Dublin, with a Northern accent, yeah. So I know how you're feeling.
Yeah, but do you know what? It's been great talking to you. It's You're such a humble guy, and no, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks very much.
Just your book before you go. Yeah. Do you want to just tell a few of our listeners about your book a little bit and the name of it? So
the book is called The Choice, and it was basically the idea was that we'd make a kind of a little bit different design wise, that you'd have your first half and your halftime talk and your second half. And a halftime talk is when something significant in your life changes the standards of how you live. So I was living my first half up until 2012. My brother John passed away 2012, which gave me my halftime talk. And that basically, reflecting on life and death, gave me a different energy in life to go and to have the purpose in life. But all the components in life, sport, business, anything I had in life, to go after it a bit more, not be selfish and kind of, you know, not want to do more in life, you know, go and achieve the things that people said you probably couldn't. And this is the second half. I'm still in my second half now, from 2012 to where I am today. And what I've achieved has been unbelievable. Not to brag about it, but just because I just thought a little bit differently. So the book is called The Choice. It was the choices John made, the choices I made. And the first half obviously is up until John passed away. Halftime in the book is when John passed away. And then the second half is where, till I wrote the book, to what I've achieved, you know.
And we link the book in the description.
Thanks, lads. Yeah.
Again, thanks for hosting us up here on Finglas. Thanks to you all for watching. Thanks for the continued support from our community and beyond. Again, there's lots of people contacting us looking for help. We hope we've replied to you all by now, and we've linked you in with services in your local community. If you haven't contacted us yet and you're humming and hawing about it, just contact us. There's no judgment. We link in with services. You don't have to suffer in silence. So with that, I say, slán leat. Thanks again to Unity Media Network for a beautiful production, for Philly for hosting us, and for Timmy for being a great co-host. So, slán.
Thank you.
This episode is sponsored by local entrepreneur Danny O'Donovan of QuickMinutes.com. QuickMinutes is a specialized meeting management application that streamlines the administrative process in running a meeting.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.